In a moment, we're going to be talking with an investigative reporter for a great television station in Nashville, Tennessee. But he's also an investigator. He's an author now. He's just signed a 2-book deal. And me being an old news director, it's going to be fun to talk with Jeremy Finley. His book is called The Darkest Time of Night. And we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. You're going to enjoy the next couple hours. Jeremy Finley's investigative reporting has resulted in criminal convictions, hearings before Congress, the payout of more than $1 million to victims, and the discovery of missing girls. He has worked and has resulted in some of the highest honors in journalism. This guy's got a National Edward R. Murrow Award, which is amazing. He's got a number of regional Emmys, 16 of them. That's amazing. He's a chief investigative reporter for WSMV Television in Nashville. He's got a 2-book deal now, and the first is called The Darkest Time of Night. That's his first novel, and he lives with his wife and daughters in Nashville. Jeremy, welcome. I'm looking forward to this.
George, I can't tell you how excited I am to be on with you this morning. You have to know that this show saved my life many times when I have made overnight trips, and just how much it has educated and informed and enlightened me. I'm a huge fan of the show, so it's a real dream come true to be on with you today.
Well, one, congratulations on all your awards. I've got 3 Emmys, so to have 16 is pretty darn good, my friend.
Well, and I appreciate that, too, and I've enjoyed always you talking about your television career. I know running some great shops along the way in St. Louis and other really legendary TV stations, so I know you know what you're talking about.
Well, our paths were close. I mean, you went to a Southern Illinois in Carbondale, didn't you?
That's right. I sure did. My undergraduate is from SIU, and I proudly went to the U of I at Springfield for my master's degree, so I'm an Illinois-educated kid.
Do you remember ever driving up toward Decatur? Did you ever go that way?
Oh, every week.
All right. Do you remember a little sign that said Iliopolis?
Of course, absolutely.
I had a horse farm there back years ago near Taylorville.
Oh,
and would just, I had 72 racehorses. We were breeding them.
Wow.
But I realized they don't stop eating.
Yeah, they
and
don't.
So I sold it before it was too late.
They really don't. That's a great story.
But I love that area. We put in a pond out there that's now a fully stocked lake and everything else. It's gorgeous.
Oh, man. Do you still have it?
I sold it to a guy who raises thoroughbred racehorses, and he loves it.
How about it?
That's something else. Now, you got a 2-book deal. How'd you pull that off?
That's an interesting question, George. I have been working for a long time, wanted to be a novelist since I was 11 years old, and just considerably worked at studying the greats in writing speculative thrillers. I am such a huge fan of the genre, and so I worked hard. I did a lot of research that you've been great to let me talk about in the next couple hours, and you know, applied that same mentality that you and I had trying to make it through in broadcasting. It is continually swimming upstream, but as long as you can study the greats, you can eventually get there, I think.
Yeah, that's true. We're going to talk about some UFOs with Jeremy a little bit later on in the program. Now, you got into investigative reporting in a very big way, but you've come across some stories that have even chilled you, haven't they?
Absolutely. These are stories. I started thinking about that when I got the good news that I'd be able to come onto the show. The stories that have really kind of shaped how I work as an investigative reporter and the crimes that have really stunned the city that I live in. And so I've unfortunately had a front row seat to these really chilling crimes and disappearances. And it's been quite a ride, and especially for the people of Nashville. These are the crimes that have really shaped our city.
Let's go through just a couple. Which one would you say for you really gets to you?
So there is nothing that gets to me more than the disappearance of Tabitha Tudors. And anybody in Nashville, anybody in the middle part of Tennessee knows this story, because it really did define for us a collective fear for this city. And, you know, every city, I think, has, unfortunately, something like this, a crime like this that literally made the whole city just stop. And that's what happened in April 29th of 2003. 13-year-old Tabitha Tudors got up that morning, woke up by her dad. Both he and his wife, her mother, went to work, and Tabitha got herself ready to go to school and just walked to the bus stop like she had thousands of times. Just 13 years old, on her way to the bus stop, and she disappears. So as soon as her parents realize at the end of the day she has not been to school, they, of course, contact police. There are questions of, oh, she may just be a runaway. Police are, frankly, a bit slow to respond. Unfortunately, the parents were not notified that she had not shown up at school that day. And I remember this day. I had only been a reporter in Nashville for about 2 months at that time. And as you know, George, working in broadcast, we get a lot of calls from people saying, someone's missing. Someone has gone running away. And you know the rules for journalism is that you really have to wait till police, you know, say, okay, we need this.
Yeah, you can't run every missing children's story, though you want to. Your heart bleeds for these. I'm going to tell you a story when we're done with yours, Jeremy, and you'll go, oh, my God. But go ahead.
You completely understand this, and I think your listeners will as well. And so the family has not been notified about this, and she's been missing all day. So, again, being a new reporter to Nashville, we finally get the call late that night from – I was working the evening shift that night, and I never will forget. They said, look, we've got a missing girl in East Nashville. So we all rush out with our live trucks, and I remember distinctly that in the far distance, it was lightning. Far distance, and you know this, George, is that when you're doing live reports, you never want lightning close by because their television masts raise up and you never want the lightning to strike. But it was in far enough a distance to where we kind of made the judgment call that this was so important we needed to get this out because this little girl had been missing all day long, and it had been only at this time to find her. So we did our reports that night, and I remember even thinking then, okay, they're going to find this kid. You know, she literally was just walking to her bus stop in the daytime, you know, in the early morning hours, but still daytime. And I remember waking up the next day and no sighting of Tabitha. A week later, no sighting of Tabitha. And any criminal investigator will tell you the first 48 hours is vital to finding a missing person. And this kid is gone. She is literally gone, and there is no trace of her. And it just inundated the news cycle for a long time. Everybody just thinking, okay, what happened to this kid? What are the sinister circumstances? Her picture was everywhere. Her parents, you know, tearfully doing interviews over and over again. And what made it especially troubling for me is that my wife and I at the time didn't live that far away from her in East Nashville.
Oh, jeez.
And so we were probably 8 or 10 blocks away. But East Nashville is one of the most famous neighborhoods in Nashville now because it has become completely gentrified and that it's one of our oldest neighborhoods. And so it's real mix of some affluent people and then some lower income. And there are some housing projects that's close by. And so it's this real mix. But it captivated our city because not only was she not found, she's never been found. She would be 28 years old today.
Is the family still hopeful that something will come of this case?
So let me tell you about this family. This family is blue collar, never had any type of exposure ever to this. They have never given up. They still to this day have a huge poster outside of their house that hangs outside of the house. Every year they talk about it. They have never, ever given up. And her parents are the nicest, sweetest folks you will have ever met in your life. And they, every time you interview them, they get the tears in their eyes and they say, we're just ready for her to come home. And I think that and this is truly what prompted a lot of why I wrote the fictionalized story of a disappearance of a child. In seeing this case, the resilience of these families and how they will deal with complete uncertainty. And I, you know, George, I have to say, I think covering a million terrible things in my career, the idea of a missing child has got to be the worst.
It's horrible. It is absolutely, and as a parent, as you are and as I am, it's the worst feeling.
It's the worst feeling, and you can never quite get, you obviously you're never going to get over it, but if your child has passed away for some awful reason, your heart's going to break, but to never know what happened to them, to never know if they're still alive, and then in a circumstance like this, no arrests, no person of suspect, nothing, this entire time vanished from a city, is astounding to me. So every time I just saw that Investigation Discovery is about to have a new documentary come out about Tabitha and her disappearance, because it is just so astounding how a little girl like this can just disappear. And it truly has. Every year that the anniversary comes up, you know, we always, as TV stations and news outlets, you know, try to remind people, hey, you know, they're still looking for her. They've done the age progression of Tabitha,
right.
All of those things. And so it truly has been that story that kind of gives you that pain in your heart every time that you go back to think about it.
It would be sad yet wonderful if she would show up at her parents' door and says, hi, Mom and Dad, it's Tabitha. I've grown up. I'm here.
Right. And that's exactly...
I was kidnapped, but I'm okay.
That's right. And that is what I think her parents have this holdout for, is that one day this might happen, that this little girl that literally vanished. And, you know, I was going back over my notes, even from back then and everything. What they think happened is still so elusive. There's one report that has been completely just investigated, because it was from a young boy at the time, that says that he saw her get into a car that morning and then was driven away. But there is no proof. There's no other recollections of it. There are no suspects. Nobody else saw it happen. There's no proof that it actually happened. And again, if this was in the middle of the night, if this was a child that was lost in the woods, if this was somewhere where, you know, no one would have seen, but this is in the middle of a neighborhood, just vanished, just completely vanished. And even now, talking about it, remembering that night, remembering the, you know, despair with the family and that storm coming in, it will forever stay with me. And, you know, I think we all kind of sit here and think, come on, you know, just come home. Just something happened for there to be some kind of explanation. But for those of us that have done stories on missing people, and you know this as well, George, is that this is a situation for people all over the country and all over the world, where somebody just vanishes and there is no explanation. And I think that the people, these families that cannot never give up and will never give up, they're truly an inspiration, and you have to honor their strength, because I think it's a strength that I don't know if many of us feel like we could have.
Well, let me tell you the story that happened to me, Jeremy. It's 1976. I'm producing the 11 o'clock news for WJBK-TV in Detroit. And we get a phone call probably about 9 o'clock at night from someone who's hysterical that their 12-year-old little boy is missing. His name was Mark Stebbins. It's Ferndale, Michigan. And, you know, as you just said, and as we agree, you just can't run missing kid stories every day. You'd have 1,000 of them.
That's right.
And there was something very strange about this phone call. And my assignment editor came up to me and said, this is a weird story. And so I took the phone call and I took down the notes. 12-year-old little boy was missing. I went with the story. I led my newscast with a missing child story of this 12-year-old named Mark Stebbins. My news director called me after the program. He has never raised his voice to me at all. I mean, we were number one in the market. And, I mean, I could walk on water with this news director.
Right.
And he screamed at me, don't you ever lead with a missing story like that again. You know, are you crazy? You know our rules, da-da-da-da. And I say, his name was Dick Graff. He's dead now. And I said, Dick, I feel really strange about this story.
Hmm.
They eventually found the little kid dead. He was the first victim of what has been called the Oakland County child killer.
Hmm.
And this guy he's gone. He's missing. They don't know who he is, the murderer. He killed four or more children. So bizarre, he would you know, neatly wrap them up and put them in snow with their arms folded and everything else. I mean, one sick person.
Right.
But I went with that story, and it turned out to be one of the biggest in the Detroit area for years.
Absolutely, that and you know, I think you have this kind of instinct, even if you're not a parent, which I wasn't at the time that Tabitha disappeared, but that you know, and I think that we should probably discuss, George, to listeners that may not understand how the news business works, is that of course we want to, when we get a call from a parent that said, "Listen, my child has run away, something has happened," you know, every journalist out there feels for them and says, "Yes, you know, we want to do a story on it," or they say, "My child is missing." But we have to rely on police to say, "Listen, we've already come in on the front end and investigated this, and we think there's a reason to be alarmed. This isn't just a runaway."
Exactly.
But it is a gut-wrenching call to sit there and say, "Oh, I know that your loved one is missing, but the police haven't deemed it yet something that we need to run on the air, so we gotta wait." And it's a tough, tough call, but I think that your listeners and readers should know that every time that they see a missing person alert on the news, it has been vetted, and it's a reason to pay attention.
That sure is. Anyways, the news director apologized when this tragedy unfolded, and he said, "I was wrong." And I said, "I don't blame you for what you did. It was just a gut feeling I had."
Yeah, that is so much a part of what we do is, you know, alerting people, because as you know, those first 48 hours are vital to finding a missing child or a missing person. And you just think the worst, and I got chills just listening to your story, because we all know this is the world that we live in. We know the worst can happen, and we, you know, you think, "Oh, please don't let this happen." And then when it does, like in a case like yours, you know, there was an extremely dangerous person that was behind all of it, and I think that's what we think in every one of these cases.
May of 1975, a couple months before he disappeared in July, I was talking with Jimmy Hoffa. And I walked him to his car. We had just put him on our newscast.
Wow.
And he was talking about how he wanted to come back and run for the presidency of the Teamsters, which he was prevented from doing. It was part of his parole, getting him out of jail. But I have a feeling he got killed, Jeremy, because he may have known a little too much about the Kennedy assassination.
You know, it's interesting when we've seen these crimes unfold, George, when you see these people die for some kinds of reason, conspiracy theories just abound. And it doesn't matter what ultimately the police say or what investigators say, you know, they take on kind of a life of their own. And I think we live in this era now where we literally are questioning everything. And this whole and I despise the term fake news, as I know as a news person yourself, it makes your skin crawl too. But we live in a world where where journalists are reporting news and finding out information, and then some government outlets are saying it's all fake. And so I think people are, you know, we're living in that era where people are like, "All right, well, tell, you know, what am I supposed to believe?" And so going back to your story about Jimmy Hoffa. It's part of what we do. We have gut instincts about stories. We have sources that tell us where to investigate and what to do. And just because it happened a long time ago doesn't mean that it might not be proven, you know, any time today. But when you have random crimes like that, and especially famous people dying, which I'm going to talk about here with our former quarterback of our football team. You know, the conspiracy theories just really take on a life of their own.
All right, stay with us, Jeremy. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk about that case, then we'll get into your book, The Darkest Time of Night, which has a little UFO twist to it, folks. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Jeremy Finley with us. We'll get to his book, The Darkest Time of Night. Great title, by the way, Jeremy.
Thank you, George.
Now, tell us about this quarterback. What's this story?
So in Nashville, there was no greater hero for a long time than Steve McNair. Steve McNair was a quarterback for the Tennessee Titans.
Oh, yes. I remember him. He was good.
He was great. He was great. And just this kind of lovable giant. He was this just 36 years old at the time of his death. And anytime you mention Steve McNair, fans went crazy, just extremely popular. And I never will forget, it was July 4th. I was heading on my way to a barbecue when I got a call from the television station. Actually, I take that back. It was from a source of mine in the police department. He said, "Listen, you need to get down here downtown. Steve McNair has been murdered." Now, he had left the Titans at that point. He was the former quarterback, obviously. And I immediately called to the news station. I said, "Listen, are you guys aware of a crime scene that's right downtown in some condos? I think Steve McNair's been murdered. I have a very credible source that did it." So rushed away from the barbecue with my family and came into work, and sure enough, McNair had been murdered. So you can imagine, this is the biggest sports hero in a town that loves its sports. We're now huge with the Predators, with hockey, but at the time, the Titans really were everything that we had. And so everyone, you know, this became obviously national news at this point that this had happened. And then the story took another incredible turn when police identified that McNair, who had been married for some considerable amount of time, a father, and again, kind of this hero figure, had been killed by his girlfriend. Her name was Sahel Kazemi, and then had killed herself.
Ugh.
So you can imagine the blow that this took to the city, and of course to McNair's, you know, family. And he's got this great wife and great kids, and here it was that, and not to be too get too tabloid on you, but he and his girlfriend had this condo that had kind of been their love nest that they had gone to. And it was the details when it started to come out were just horrific, that she had shot him and killed him and then taken her own life. And then the twists and turns, it was that she felt like that he was seeing somebody else, when in fact he had been seeing somebody else, all under the guise that no one had known that this was going to happen.
Gosh.
And the police chief at the time said that she believed that her relationship with McNair was unraveling and that she was spinning out of control. This was a 20-year-old Iranian immigrant that had been dating McNair about 6 months prior. They met at a restaurant where she had worked, and they had began this really torrid love affair. But I'll tell you, we talked earlier about Jimmy Hoffa and some of the other, you know, salacious crime stories of our time that take on this conspiracy theory or this life of their own. But almost immediately, people started to question, wait a second, here is this strong 36-year-old former quarterback, and his small girlfriend, lover, is the one who killed him? How in the world is that possible? And that was what has fueled this conversation for so long. And even to this day, people in town will say, "I don't believe Steve McNair was killed by that woman. I don't believe that's what happened. I believe that there was something else to it." And when you got back to look at how he was murdered, he was shot 5 times. And even again, to this, like I said, to this day, people have said, how is this possible? Now, we've seen, unfortunately, in many, many cases how, you know, crimes of the heart, where people will snap. But this is one of those stories where people have always questioned, do we really know what happened? And police have, you know, defended their case over and over again, saying that there was, you know, intensive evidence as everything that had happened. But it really was that crime. It was the tabloid crime, probably of the decade, at least for Nashville, because this
sounds like a hit, Jeremy, doesn't it?
So it's interesting you say that, George, because we all thought about this. We're like, okay, you know, how does this happen? She's dead. He's dead. You know, police have said, listen, they thought that literally he was sleeping on the couch and she came up and shot him all of these times. But it does. It does. Initially, there was no question that reporters all across the city were thinking, okay, this is what happened. This is a hit job. This is exactly what happened. But police in Nashville, we have an incredible police force here, and they thoroughly investigated this, and they determined this is what happened. And we've all looked at the evidence because the case is closed now, and so we can look at the case, and it was a bloodbath. And not to be too gross, gruesome in that condo, but it was a true horror scene of what happened in there. But like you said, George, you hear that story and you think, oh my gosh, this is a hit job. But to this day, police believe that she did it.
Unbelievable. Now let's talk about The Darkest Time of Night. Tell me about that headline.
So it really references two things. The story tells the fictionalized account, of course, this is a speculative thriller, of the disappearance of a U.S. senator's grandson. And when he disappears, he's 7 years old, it happens in the middle of the night in the woods behind the house. But the book, the title doesn't just come from the time of night that it happened, but also what this family goes through to try to find him, because this literally is the darkest chapter in their lives. And of course, the FBI comes in. It finds out that this U.S. senator is about to accept the vice president ticket on a presidential campaign. So there's a lot of speculation that this is politically motivated, that this boy has disappeared to stop this campaign. But there's only one person who truly believes that she knows what happened, and that is the boy's grandmother, because the only witness to this disappearance is the boy's brother. And when the boy disappears, all the brother will say is, the lights took him.
Whoa.
And then he disappears. And the boy never talks again about what he saw. So what we've tell in this story is the reason the grandmother knows this is that in the 1950s and 60s, she was a researcher of missing people, especially those that disappeared into beams of light. And she has to make the decision. It's a secret she's kept from her family that she did this research. And she has to go back to her research and the people who she researched with to try and find out what happened to her grandson.
What made you spin it with a UFO story?
So I will be completely honest with you. I've always been fascinated by this, but it is your show. It is coast to coast, and listening to the show so many times overnight, making trips and traveling, and I would listen to your guests and Art's guests and talk about this, and I'd always had a fascination about it, but it wasn't until I listened to this show and could hear these people telling these stories, and you had these experts on, and these were brilliant people. These were not people that were crackpots. These were people with tangible stories. And so in working in the world that I live in with proof and with documentation, I thought, I'm going to go back to the research that these people have done. I'm going to go back and really study this issue. And so much of this has to do with these unexplained disappearances and unexplained phenomenon. And the fiction writer in my head thought, this is an incredible story to tie these two together, to tie together our real world experiences and then what may be happening with UFOs. And being a reporter is my day job, I can only deal with truths and facts. But when, in writing this fiction, I really leaned heavily on the research of people that have studied this and was able to craft this story. And I can't wait for people to read it. I really hope that they're going to enjoy what we've come up with.
Jeremy, even though it's a novel, it could be true. It could be nonfiction.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I'll tell people this, what the plot of the story is, and they'll say, well, how do we know that isn't real? And that's the thing that I think just is so astounds all of us that live in this era. And there's so much, as you know, George, that has come out recently about UFO sightings with the military, and it's really kind of reawakened this concept of what's happening to these people who disappear. How can people just vanish? And you and I know, being news people, that they vanish for all kinds of awful reasons, abductions and human trafficking and drug addiction and murders and all of this. But then there are those cases where you have no explanation. And I truly think that's what fueled my writing this book, is having interviewed so many families that have experienced this grief, and And of course, not at all basing my fictionalized novel on their despair, because that would be cruel. But looking at their faith and their belief that, you know, something happened to their loved one that is unexplained. And I truly think when I was writing this book, I was like, I have to see if I can come up with a connection here that would not only make for hopefully a great thriller, but really, you know, I think I'm trying to find an answer myself in my fictionalized head to say, listen, you know, this is what I think, you know, this was what could happen. But I hope really the book reflects these, what so many people really go through in these missing cases. But yes, I mean, who's to tell? And that's, I think the fun part of reading speculative thrillers, but also at the same time gets us thinking, what don't we know about why people are disappearing?
You know, in being a skeptic is healthy. I've said this time and time again, as long as you're open-minded to the possibilities.
I think so, and I think that you have to, I like to talk about this, especially with people with this, again, this term of fake news, is that you have to do your own research. And, you know, it's easy to dismiss something. It's easy to sit there and say, oh, that can't possibly be true. But you know what? I spent a whole lot of time doing a whole lot of research into people who have investigated UFOs, and I'm just like you. I'm an extreme skeptic with a very open mind, but I can't help but look at this research that they have done, and I can't help but look at all of these cases when people on one side of the planet who have never met describe encounters that people on the other side of the planet have experienced, that there has to be something that is worth investigating. There has to be something that we don't understand, and because I'm an extreme skeptic, I love to do my research, and I love to listen to these people that have spent extraordinary amounts of time looking at this. I just think that you're absolutely right that we have to be skeptics, but at the same time, if you've got that open mind, you're going to be exposed to things that you may never have ever anticipated could actually be true.
Our guest is Jeremy Finley. His book we're talking about, it's called The Darkest Time of Night. We're going to take phone calls with him next hour. And if you have questions talking to a real news person, give him a call. You might have questions about stuff. What do you think of the fake news attack on media these days?
So I will be completely honest with you, George. It gets under my skin like there is no tomorrow.
The attack or the possibilities?
It's the attack, and I'll tell you why. And I'd like to really talk about this with you and your listeners to weigh in as well. You and I know this. Nobody gets into journalism because we want somebody to tell us what to report, right?
Right. And we also don't get into it to nail somebody. We don't get in there to get people.
Absolutely. This is not why you get into journalism. It attracts people who, of course, want to be writers, but also really want to find the truth of the matter, and they want to serve their communities. And so it is extremely disheartening for me to see this term of fake news be used against journalists that are, in many times, you know, risking everything they have to try to expose something. I'll give you an example here. I recently did an undercover operation and spent extreme amounts of time compiling public documents to investigate this individual that was the head of a government agency. And I went to him and I said, listen, I called him on the phone. I said, listen, I've got this video of you, you know, showing you doing some things that are a waste of taxpayer dollars. I've got all this documentation. I want to show this to you so you know, and you can reply and you can have your side of the story. And the official said, my president thinks you're fake news, and I think you're fake news too, and I don't have to talk to you. And it struck me then that I thought, listen, I'm trying to share with you my research, my work that I've done, so you know what I have. You're familiar with what I have on you. And he immediately used the fake news term. Now, I will say, he has since been fired from that position. He has since been the subject of a scathing state investigation and potentially faces criminal charges because of what we exposed. So I think that is part of what I hope people will learn about the news industry is and realize about the news industry. Like you said, we're not out to get anybody. We want to do fair and accurate stories.
Most people do. Most people do.
I think so. You know, but again, I come back to that thing that, yes, there are going to be pundits and commentators that are out there. And I think this is part of the problem, is that people confuse pundits and commentators with journalists. There's a huge, vast difference. And it's made cable news extremely successful in primetime programming.
See, in the days of Walter Cronkite and people like that, David Brinkley, Chet Huntley, you didn't know what their personal opinion was on a news issue.
Absolutely.
They reported it. They put it out there. They let you make up your own mind, and they reported it the way that they saw it, and the reporters. But at no point was there an injection of opinion from Walter Cronkite. I don't remember it in my day.
I think it's, and even from Edward R. Murrow, who famously took on administrations, if there was doubt, if there was perhaps a hint of mistrust, I think it was healthy, because the American people knew these are newsmen and women who are skeptical about what they're being told from the government.
Let's take some calls with you, Jeremy, when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.